This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Hi, I'm Nick Ravelis, the Geisel Director of Education and Outreach for San Diego Opera. As you know, we have a number of opportunities for you to get to know opera and our current season by tuning in here to UCSD-TV. One of our most exciting offerings is Stars in the Salon. This series is an opportunity for you, our audience, to meet the singers, the conductors, and the stage directors who create our productions. Taped before a live audience, the artists discuss their roles, the music, and the stories behind the operas. It's especially entertaining and informative for those of you who are new to opera. Join us now for Stars in the Salon, and I'll see you at the opera. Welcome to this roundtable concerning Ildebrando Pizzetti's Murder in the Cathedral. San Diego Opera is proud that we are producing this opera for the very first time in its entirety, fully staged. It was done on stage at Carnegie Hall back in 1958-59, just after its premiere. It was done in Montreal once, I think, and this actually is the very first time that we're going to hear and see all of it professionally staged by, of course, one of the major opera companies in the country. So we've got a brilliant cast here, and almost all of them have joined me tonight for this roundtable. So let me begin right here on my right, making her debut with us in the role of the first chorister, Susan Neve. He doesn't really need much introduction. He's been here many, many times before. He's sung all of the Dons, Giovanni, Basilio, Quixote, which was the last time that he was with us, of course, the basso, Ferruccio Fulinetto. Making his San Diego Opera debut, conducting the San Diego Symphony in this wonderful production, is the conductor Donato Renzetti. Our general director, artistic director, is also our stage director, and he has stage directed a number of pieces on our main stage, Katya Kabanova, Falstaff, there was a Traviata in there, I believe, and a few other things, Don Quixote, Ian Campbell, of course. Singing the role of the Herald, he's gone from Herod to Herald because he was our Herod last year. And we were so pleased, and I want to speak personally, I was just so delighted to hear him actually sing the role of Herod in Salome instead of shout it or bark it, as you often hear it. It was just a revelation. Thank you for being here again in the rather small role of the Herald, Alan Glassman. And then another stalwart, a favorite of ours, who's been here many, many times, bass Kevin Langan, who will be singing The Fourth Tempter and The Fourth Night. So thank you all for being here. I want to start with Ian because, of course, the idea of doing Assassino nella Cattedrale, Murder in the Cathedral, came from him. And I want to just start by asking you, Ian, can you trace for us your history with this piece? How did the idea of doing it begin with you?
It actually goes back to the 1970s when I was running the State Opera of South Australia in Adelaide. I was given a pirate reel-to-reel recording of the world premiere. You can now get it on CD legitimately, but this was a pirate. And this is before, you know, cassettes and so on. And I played it and was immediately taken in by the quality of the music, the extraordinary chorus work, but also the power of the piece. It just kept driving forward in such an exciting way. And I wanted to stage it in Adelaide. Now, it premiered in 1958, and this was in the 70s. And my board of directors said to me, you know, it's modern. And I said, musically, it doesn't go into that nasty category of an accident involving cats in a kitchen, which so much modern music did at the time. I said, it's really quite romantic in its style. But they said, you know, our audience isn't ready. And although I had control of the artistic side, I said, OK, I'll go along with you. And it went on to the back burner. I've known Ferruccio for more than 30 years, and as you know, we've worked through a lot of his repertoire over the years, and it was the obvious vehicle for him, and eventually we got around to it, and here we are. And you could not have a greater Beckett than him. And with him as the central piece, it was really easy to encourage a high-quality cast to work around him, and I think you'll be very happy. But that's the story. It goes back to the 70s.
Maestro, can you tell us about the role of the orchestra in this piece, and in terms of telling the story and setting the atmosphere for this story?
Buonasera. Buonasera. I don't speak English. Maybe. With the hand, Italian with the hand. No, allora, I condotto this opera 2 times with Ferruccio, in Trieste, Wonderful City Italian, and La Scala di Milano. And the conductor, the first conductor, Maestro Gavazzini, was my teacher. And when I was young, and speak with me, Donato is my name, Donato, study Murder of Cathedral, because it's a wonderful opera. It's really, it's the opera, new fantastic from the between the old opera. The last opera Italian was Turandot. You know Turandot, the Puccini. And now is the first opera, the new modern composer, with melodia, because opera is melodia, but with the parte new melodica modern. But the orchestra and chorus is the principal, together with Arcivescovo. Arcivescovo is killed. He's dead. Orchestra, no. Maybe with me. I don't know. But the orchestra is fantastic orchestration, you know, because the sound is black sound. All the opera is a black sound, but with the melodia. Black sound is the section, the posane, trombone, timpani, double bass and brass. Is the principal in orchestra is violoncelli. Violoncelli for accompagnare, come si dice accompagnare?
Accompany
the singers. Every singers have 1 or 2 instruments in the same part. And after tomorrow, the 6th probe, my job is understand the singers, where is the stringed instrument che accompagnano this melody. Fantastica opera, is a serious opera, e come si dice, combination. When yesterday I look with the costume for Nanetto, you know, I am Catholic, and in two days before is a Pope.
Right.
I look in Fulanetto as a new Pope.
Right.
You come because the opera is not only Bohème, or Italian opera, Bohème, Traviata, Carmen, the cultura, e anche new opera. It's a new opera, and congratulations for the theater for have this new production.
Let's turn to Beckett. Ferruccio, can you describe the music that Bizzetti has written for you? How does it...
Well, you know, from the very first moment when I approached this role, I was immediately caught by the atmosphere that this music can create. Immediately you have the feeling of the drama that will happen. And the way he treated the female chorus is so amazing. I mean, this lady, this fanatic religious waiting for the return of the Archbishop, are singing amazing moments in this piece. And I am very grateful to Pizzetti for this sensational finale primo, I must say. The finale primo,
the end of Act One, yeah,
is beyond imagination. It becomes melodic, mm-hmm, and extremely dramatic and very demanding vocally. But it's so well written for the voice that actually is not such a big effort. And from the first time when we did it in Trieste with Maestro Renzetti, I was absolutely fascinated by it. I heard for years and years and years about this role, because it was a very important role done by Rossi Lemeni, and Rossi Lemeni had a reputation to be a singing actor, which I wanted to become, and I did, luckily. And I remember that when they asked me, what would you like to do to come back here in Trieste? And I said, well, I want to finally do this as a senior. And in the moment I started to look at this piece, I was immediately caught. Mm. Immediately caught. And it's another great, great privilege that I get from my career, because talking about singing acting roles, this one doesn't have anything less than King Philip or Boris Godunov or Don Quixote. It is absolutely a sensational piece and role. And I'm trying to do it as much as I can everywhere, because I think that after 50 years of total abandon, it should be time to repropose it.
Hmm. It is, as we spoke the other day during our podcast, that it is, in a way, a one-man show.
Yeah.
However, there are many other characters, and I wanted to bring some of those singers who are singing these smaller parts in, simply to talk about how they feel that they fit. Let's start with the first chorister, who doesn't even have a name. It's a shame. However, she may be the corifea, as they say in Italian, the first chorister, but she also has the only aria.
Ta-da!
So, Susan, tell us about the first chorister.
I think Susan, hello. I think she represents the voice of the people of Canterbury, who have eagerly been awaiting the return of Thomas Becket to us. Even though we understand that he's in serious trouble and it could not bode well for him if he did come back to us, he is our leader in every sense. And I think Pizzetti versus Verdi, who, when he uses female choruses like in Macbeth, they really say everything that they have to. But I think Pizzetti decided, well, let's have two girls that agree with what the rest of the chorus is saying, but then put in their little extra 2 cents. And so there's a soprano chorister and a mezzo chorister. And I am a Verdi Puccini girl, so this was a stretch for me. But I do get the aria. Yay! and actually, the aria has its moments. When I was learning this, I just thought, wow, this is not sticking in my brain or my ear. But Kristen Roach, our pianist, said, oh, Susie, this page is just like Butterfly. And this page is like Tosca. And now it works. You know, make it something familiar. And So I've really, I enjoy, and it's also nice having someone else carry the weight of the opera on his shoulders, because I, you know, do Turandot and Aida and Lady Macbeth, and I've had my share of carrying the opera. Now it's his turn. Ah. Yay. But you'll love it. It's great.
Talk about luxury casting. Alan, you've been with us as Prince Shuisky in Boris, and last season as Herod, as we said. You've sung Otello and Canio all over the world. Now, I just want to tell you that officially you have the distinction of being the singer with the smallest role ever to serve on this round table.
Yay! What do I win?
There should be a statuette or something. But so I thought it would be really fun to ask you what the challenges are of singing such a small role. You are the herald.
I keep talking about this. Actually, the role makes me very nervous.
Really?
Because I keep going over and over and over. Every time, Ian probably sees me right before I come on, I'm going through it every time because I'm not doing a big role. It's very concentrated. You have a very important statement that the herald is making.
And that is what?
It's a foreboding of what's going to happen. And he's telling these men, listen, you need to listen to me. Everything is not good. And something may happen. I'm not telling them what, but there is a foreboding. And I'm the one that starts it off by saying that. But the role actually makes me, because it is small but concentrated, it makes me nervous. Because I just finished doing a Canio just a few weeks ago. It's a lot, for me it's harder than that because I don't get a chance. I have 5 minutes to show something.
Is all together.
Yes,
easier. I've got two lines here, lines over there.
Right.
So.
Which is much more difficult.
We'll trade.
Okay. Yeah. But I'm just saying.
I'm wearing a veil anyway. They won't be able to tell if it's you or me. Yeah.
But I just keep going over and over and over it because I keep thinking, God, I've only got 5 pages. I can't make a mistake. But I'm really enjoying it. And Ferruccio is one of my favorites of all time. And I just watching him is always a great pleasure for me. Great, great pleasure. And the rest. And we do have a great cast. And I have great friends in this cast, which also is wonderful, also, like Kevin. And so it's great being with our friends. And I really think this is going to be a great show. I really do. It's really great.
Kevin, how about you? You're singing actually, it's a very pivotal role. It's not as small as one would think. You've got two roles. You are the fourth tempter as well as the fourth knight, one of the knights who slays Becket at the end. Yeah. I want to ask you to focus a little bit on the fourth tempter. Mm-hmm. That has its own challenges. What's going on there?
The tempters, well, there are four tempters in the first act, and the first three are basically are human characters, and we kind of carry the story for you because we are the ones that set up why this is going to happen, why Thomas is in trouble and with the archbishop, with the king, and why the king. It's the age-old story of who had the power, the church or the state. So that went on for hundreds and hundreds of years. And in this case, my particular role, the tempter, when I first started looking at it, and I started looking at it last summer, I wasn't quite sure who he was because he's an ethereal character. I first thought he was the devil. Because he gets inside of Becket's head in the scene that I have with him, and he convinces him to become a martyr and to allow himself to die for his cause. And then I called Ian last summer because I wasn't quite sure if that was the way we were going to go with the production. And I called Ian and I said, what exactly do you have in mind with this character? So I know when I'm working on the text, because it's very, very wordy. There's a lot of dialogue in this opera for all of the singers. Okay, so Ian said to me, he said, well, I think I see him as Thomas Becket's doppelganger. He is his conscience. And I thought, wow, this is fabulous. That's a great idea. And so I then continued to work on the role for the last year with that in mind. And when we got here, he told me, he said, you will be dressed exactly like the archbishop himself, and you will almost come out of his body in your scene. And you are the one that convinces him to become a martyr and allow himself to be killed by the knights in the second act at the behest of the king. So it's an interesting opera because it's the other thing I wanted to point out is we break the fourth wall quite a bit in this opera. We talk to the audience, and especially at the end of the opera, as the knights who come in, I come in my second role as one of the fourth knights to kill him. After we kill him, we come downstage to the front of the stage, and we explain to the audience, we try to justify why we did what we did to not only ourselves, but to the public, to you, so that we all say, yes, this was the right thing to do, he had to be killed, but he was a good man. So it's going to be really interesting for us to do that, to communicate to you that, and for you to have an opinion at the end of the opera as to what you, if you think what we did was the right thing in having Beckett killed. Because I think that's the story that I think Eliot wanted through the poetry and that Pizzetti wants in the opera, is for the public that comes to see this to decide for yourselves at the end of the opera if we were justified in killing Beckett. So that's left up to you.
That begs a question of Ian. Occasionally, evidently, when the opera is produced, in fact, sometimes when the play is produced, the T.S. Eliot play that the opera is based on, that final section of the knights justifying themselves is cut. You've opted to retain it. Why?
Yes, it really has to be retained, because although we see this progression of condemnation that is starting to hang over Beckett's head, I think it helps the audience think again about the issues involved when these guys come down. Think of what happens all the time. You know, we hit somebody with a bomb, we hit somebody with a drone, and then we say, well, we did it because. And he was a nice guy and he had a family, but, you know, we had to take him out. It's almost that kind of discussion that is going on, and they rationalize it in extraordinary ways. Nobody did a better job as chancellor than he did. You know, well, if he was such a great chancellor, why did you kill him? Well, we killed him because his ego became so great. When he became archbishop, he opposed the king. And it's a very interesting theatrical technique to have them come down and address you. And then we go into a big choral finale, which is quite spectacular. I wanted to catch up on one point, though. When we say small roles, there's the old saying, there are no small roles, only small actors. If this opera is to work, you need people like these in the so-called small roles. Far too often, you see operas where there's a couple of stars and then the others are from the student ensemble or something like that. If you do that with this work, you don't have the strength. And if you have somebody like Ferruccio, you have to make sure that you have people who sing leading roles doing what are, in fact, leading roles. They're all very, very important. They're brief when you add up the number of bars compared with singing Canio or whatever. But in terms of importance, they're just as important. And that's why even the Herald, when he comes on and makes his declarations, if you do it with a second-rate voice, a second-rate character, the opera's already dead. But when you have somebody come on with the strength that we have here, the opera immediately starts to surge forward because the statements are made with such declamatory power, which is what we need. So when we say small roles, we mean briefer than you might be used to, but in terms of the quality of the singing, it's exactly what you expect in every so-called big role.
You know, that word declamation or declamato is used a lot about this opera. Ferruccio, can you explain that a little more to us?
Well, I think that the Pizzetti style is very much in this opera, is very much based on that. For one good reason, also because the libretto is not just a libretto. The libretto is a very, very faithful translation from the original T.S. Eliot romance. And therefore, whatever is said in this piece, it has a great, is very, very profound. And you cannot just say it and thinking about the music. I mean, what is happening on stage in this relatively short time of this opera, it's a tremendous amount of dramatic events. I mean, not only, let's do not forget that it's history. We have to recreate history. And Pizzetti very much based everything on the almost exaggerated pronunciation of this wonderful, profound text. And it became basically the most important characteristic of his writing, opera. And I'm very grateful because I am a singer who always has privileged saying the text, whether it's in Italian, in Russian, or whatever. Because music is fundamental, is fascinating, but the words are the most important vehicle to reach the hearts of the people who is listening. Mm-hmm. And this opera, conceived in the way it is conceived, gives you the greatest possibility for doing that.
I'd like to ask the other singers, too, about the libretto. I went to the very first music rehearsal, and there were a lot of stops and starts on words and on text and shaping that text properly. There were even some mistakes, I think, that Maestro Renzetti pointed out that were in the score. Is the libretto, is it different enough Italian from the Italian that you sing in so many other roles that it's a little complicated for you?
There are a lot of words, and this, nothing's repeated. So there just seems to be a lot more words and syllables than there are eighth notes and 16th notes. And it's one of those roles where you really needed to, you know, to really find out where the syllables are going to go, and then it fits in. And the minute Ferruccio got here, and I thought, yeah, see, because he's Italian, he knows how to do this, and it works. I mean, but for the rest of us who are not Italians, you have to make it sound like we are. And I think it's been a lot of concentration, and it seems to be a couple of places where the accent is a little misplaced or something, but it does work. It does work, and I think the fact that it will be super titled for everybody, you'll know exactly what we're saying at every second. Beckett's part is very archbishop-like, you know? But I'm talking about flowers and birds and bees and stuff, and it's like, okay. But he does too. You say nel giardino, that's right. See, so there's garden themes going throughout the whole opera, and but it's wonderful. But yeah, getting around the text was,
it's conversational Italian, it really
it is.
Conversational
and, Italian.
But at the same time, I discovered when we first got here and we were using the piano to rehearse, it was harder to pick up the colors of the text from the piano line because there's not enough fingers for the rehearsal accompanist to play everything that's in the score. When you hear the score, when you hear the orchestra score, then you hear all of the colors that go along with your dialogue that you're saying. So it's actually, I think it's going to be easier for us to sing with the orchestra than it is with the piano, because we'll hear a lot
that's
more.
That's interesting.
You know?
Yeah.
Interesting, because it's difficult because it's the old Italian, really old Italian. It's difficult for us Italian, but the problem is the tone, see? The
sì.
Tone musically, mm-hmm. che is come il vecchio Gregoriano, the old Gregorian music. You have a wonderful tradition, the church, the cathedral, the chorus, and Pizzetti write always come Gregoriano, che the conductor before, no, with the stick, with the hand. It's difficult for the singers, mm-hmm. no?
See?
It's difficult for you. Yeah. How many minutes to stay? How many minutes you stay in the
five?
Oh yeah.
And you, I 1 hour and 50.
Yes.
Right.
No, it's difficult concentration. You have raised on Susan and il declamato è un po' come lo Sprechensdeutsch quando c'è di Schoenberg.
Yeah. Mm. It is like.
Is a problem.
German, spoken German.
Ma with the melodia, the fantastico yeah. Pizzetti, because it's with the melody, you remain. The finale first act, the intermezzo, the beginning del secondo atto is a music fantastica, and the finale. Every part is really difficult. But it's difficult for Lanetto, but the aria, the Susan, is a micidiale.
It's a killer. even though I'm talking about the birds and the bees, it is so not light and fluffy. It's really hard. And also vocally, it's not that it goes that high. I mean, I have a couple of high B flats, which are not high, but he keeps me in what we call the passaggio and higher. So a lot of the opera, I'm kind of up there, and which means I've got to be as perfect as possible because you can hear me. So but it's a tough thing to sing because I'm always up there. But it's good though. It's good.
No matter what the opera is, singers are always looking for color in the text, not just sing the notes, but emphasize what has to be emphasized. That's one of the joys of this piece, because it's written in a way that it demands digging into the text, I think, a little more than some other operas. So you'll hear everybody using their voices to color the sound, still singing the correct note, the correct rhythm, but giving you a taste of what the words really mean. And I think everybody is digging into that very, very strongly.
I have a feeling, too, that Pizzetti, at least from everything that I've read and with my familiarity with the piece to this point, that he seems to be doing with Italian what Janáček was trying to do with Czech. He's trying to find the exact way he wants to capture the rhythm of spoken Italian.
And Strauss, too. I mean, Strauss was doing it in the German rep. Yeah.
So that the music, the melodic line, the vocal line really fits the Italian text as perfectly as possible. I imagine so that it can be clearly understood, right? Mm-hmm. I think that would make sense.
Because the concept that is everywhere, especially in the first act, especially when he's dealing with a temptation, the concepts expressed in this moment are so intellectual and so difficult also that in order to make them somehow clearer, you have really to go into that direction of pronouncing and saying the thing with the maximum clarity.
With intention.
Yeah.
Ian, tell us a little bit about the set and the costumes, because I think it's exciting that we're building this locally.
Yes, it's totally local, local designers. The costumes are fairly traditional in appearance. You will see that they're of the era, of the 1100s. We haven't attempted to be absolutely perfect, but there are some interesting things. There are some clothes that Ferruccio wears that are duplicates of what we know Beckett wore, because some of his clothes are still in France. The set itself is what we call a unit set. It's the single set on stage, but it has huge pillars reaching up to God, which is what all of the great cathedrals have. They're always driving your eye upward towards God, and I think you'll see that here. There are lots of pillars. If you go to Canterbury, there are lots of pillars. And the event of the murder of Beckett actually took place in a kind of a side chapel. It wasn't in the main part of the cathedral. Here it will be, because that's the tradition that you tend to do, and you can't fit the chorus into the side chapel anyway. But the presence of the pillars and the way we're going to light it will narrow the focus down very, very much. It is a huge set when you look at it. In fact, I invite you after this, just have a look in the doors. We have it up on stage now. It's not lit, but you'll see the size of it. And then when the people are on it, they are still dominated by the church, and that's a part of the concept. Ralph and I looked at abstracting it in various ways. We experimented with broken pillars and things leaning over. But the church wasn't falling down. The church was still fairly healthy. It was just being managed by the wrong people. So we decided, no, it's still the solid church, and the drama is in the text. That's where it lies. And if you want to prepare yourself for this opera, buy the T.S. Eliot play. It's inexpensive. Get it through Amazon. Read that. You know the opera, because it is so close to the same. And then you'll be ready for anything. But the sets and costumes will bring you into the era very, very firmly.
Maestro, tell us a little bit about the role of the chorus in this opera, because it's very important.
is tremendous. It's very difficult opera for the choir. I don't remember opera, maybe Moshe Aharon, the Schoenberg, is difficult. But before I come here, I speak with Furlanetto, who stayed many years, and he said, Ferruccio, but you okay, orchestra is okay, but the choro is fantastic. And choro is fantastic. Mm. It's really, really. Congratulations.
But in terms of the role that the chorus plays in the opera...
Coro is a people, no? At the beginning, wait, the Arcivescovo, is really declamato, beginning with the coro. But a difference that the singers, the coro is always in with the note, the same note. No? You diviso in 3-4 parts. Is very difficult because the singers have one part only. The coro is together and diviso with other basso baritone. It's very difficult for this. And the problem is staging. Normally, the coro, Italian coro, stay in front of the public, sing and go. Here, no, because he's a very, very actor, no? So, attore. This is important because cantare is melodia with the tone. And with the intonation, just intonation, because it's not easy. You know, Susan sing only Susan, Purlonetto sings only Susan, but when I sing this opera, the basso, baritono, listen near the tenor, have another note, other things, is very difficult, because it's difficult for the coro. Mm. But the coro is really important for the drama, the opera, the Iliad.
Yeah. Ian?
One important thing with the chorus in the way we are doing it here is that they are on stage throughout the opera. They're watching what's going on, the women, because they are the women of Canterbury, and at the very beginning they arrive at the cathedral wondering why they're there. What drew us here? Is there a premonition of disaster? And as they finish their first chorus, they make it very clear by saying, all we can do is watch. So I decided they will watch. So they will always be in the sides of the stage watching what goes on, but totally unable to do a thing about it. They're like a Greek chorus in that regard. The difference between these and a Greek chorus is that the Greek chorus is not seen by anybody. They comment all the time, but in this case, the chorus is seen. Beckett sees them and the priests see them. But they'll keep going out of the action, coming back into the action, out of the action. That makes even greater demands with the musical issues they have to deal with. They also have to move around a lot, but they're handling it brilliantly.
I imagine an opera like this, and this is a question for the singers, that it's not just a problem of memory with all those words, but it's also a problem of remembering your cue, what line that the other singer is singing that you're supposed to jump in on at what time. Have you found that challenging, Kevin or Alan?
Yeah, I mean, when I was learning it, I spent as much time looking at everybody else's roles around me as I did with my own, because you really have to depend on your colleagues in this opera for your cues. One character goes into the other constantly, or Beckett. When we're arguing with Beckett, in the second act is Knights. We're bantering back and forth with him over, you know, trying to get him to change his ways, to see things the way the king wants them seen, and he refuses. And so we find ourselves at the end having no choice but to just have to follow through with the murder. But it was very, very difficult, and it still is. I mean, it's a tricky, since it's so tricky rhythmically, if one person gets off, you can throw everybody else off too. So we have to be really, really careful. Luckily, we have a prompter, which is going to help us with this particular production. So his job is just to keep an eye on making sure that we stay, you know, exactly at the right place at the right time, because Maestro's got his hands full with the orchestra as well in this. It's so busy a piece.
The prompter was always a very important thing from the very beginning when we did it in Italy. When we did it in Milano, we had to fight with the people of La Scala, who were very much against, not the prompter himself, about the cover of the prompter, because it doesn't look good, he said. And in an opera like this, where
it's dangerous.
Musically is so complex and so difficult and so overlapping, I mean, if somebody or some part of the chorus will lose its way. It's a domino effect.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the last, we need to have always the prompter just to be safe and to be and to trust in him to be able to save situation of that can happen. Really, I remember, but there is no other opera like this with this difficulty.
And the thing to remember here is that only one member of the cast has sung the opera previously. For everybody else, it's brand new. And I need you to do something for me, and that is to keep praying for good health. There is nobody else in the country who know these roles. No one. So these people are popping their pills every day, and we need your prayers to keep everybody healthy.
Let's take some questions from the audience. Does anyone have any questions for anyone on our panel?
Since this is a very text-heavy opera, and without repeats, as Susan said, what is that? How does that translate into the supertitles? Are we constantly going to see long lines of supertitles changing?
No, they're very easy to follow. I wrote them. The timing is good. The text is clear, and you'll have no trouble following them. They're not flashing up all the time, and they're written so clearly. You will catch two lines more quickly than you think, and you'll never be missing anything important.
Are there questions? Anyone over here? Over here, yeah.
Where are the prompters?
It's in a box in the front of the stage.
Prompters in a little box. You'll see them in front.
Is a prompter?
You won't see him. You won't see him. We see him. Yeah, yeah. He's covered by a shell. Yeah.
Like this. No. Just one.
Yeah, and he's right in sight with the conductor. We see the conductor over his head, and so we can see both of them at the same time.
But the prompter is a very traditional Italian tradition. The prompter is the last 4 years with the stage director, no Campbell, don't want for the view.
I don't want them usually, but in this time I have.
But the tradition was this, in the near. We have in Italy, we have 150 theater in Italia, lyric opera. In little country have a theater and a prompter. No strings, but prompter usually. is really important for the singer before. And I stopped because I'm a little crazy, but little history, very sympathetic history for the prompter. Arena di Verona, you know Arena di Verona is very big, famous house, the opera, is a big stage. It was the big house from the prompter. And the staging is always in a little, what is the clivio?
Rake.
And one time at Arena di Verona, Aida, with the elephant, with the horse. And one elephant stopped in front of the prompter. The prompter was a small man with a cigar and glasses. No, but elefante beginning to fare la pipì. Where's the pipì?
Yes.
The two men take this prompter because elefante... It's necessary, the prompter.
It won't happen here.
No.
Martina Arroyo tells a story of a prompter. She was doing some opera that had great coloratura in it, and she's singing away, and she got lost. She didn't know where she was, but she kept going, and she looked down to the prompter for help, and he was sitting there going, brava, brava.
The beginning of the story.
We have another question over here.
Could I ask each of you whether you have an absolute favorite moment in the opera, and if so, which moment is your favorite?
Let's start with Susan. Your aria, right?
Oh, absolutely. That would have been my first choice. No, actually, it's not my aria. My favorite part of the opera is the end of Act One. All the women's chorus are praying and hoping that Beckett decides to get the hell out of Dodge so that he, I'm sorry, so that he doesn't get hurt. And he sings incredibly beautiful music. And it's melodic and it's passionate and it's a perfect ending to the first act. And I think it really sets the mood for the rest of the opera. And it's gorgeous. Yeah. It's gorgeous, especially the way Federico does it.
The finale primo is absolutely stunning.
Amazing. Yeah.
From when the Archbishop starts to remember his youth, and he goes on towards the final decision to go for martyrdom, and the way this finale primo is written for Beckett is absolutely stunning. I would say something more, because not very seldom in opera you have moments that you do first of all for yourself and then eventually from an audience. It is the case of the death of Don Quixote, it is the case of the death of Boris, the aria of King Philip, and this. When I am on stage and that moment arrives, then I do it for myself.
Maestro, your favorite moment?
No, sure. I'm a conductor. A conductor ama, love, or opera, because the singer sings aria, duet, go in the room, but the conductor stays here. Every note, every moment is important for the conductor, no? But sure, the beginning of the opera, the atmosphere, the situation, the black sound, and when the cambells immediately the cathedral, and after, when inside the coro, Arcivesco, inside the moment, very important. Finale first act, intermezzo, finale di opera, is the last bar. Because when audience applause, I think, okay, now eat spaghetti.
Ian, how about yourself?
Well, I love every note in the piece, but there's one brief moment, and it's shorter than the end of Act One, where Ferruccio becomes sort of transfigured, and he sings that marvelous little bit about now he knows where he's going. That very brief one at the top of the steps. When you hear that, you know that he is a man who's gone into another world. And it's only about a minute long, but it is so gorgeous that, sing it.
<It's> very high.
Alan?
Oh, gosh. I love the, I can't say my part. I love doing my part, but I love this whole opera. And I've been enjoying watching the rehearsals so much of this. And it's the whole opera is great. I'm really enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. Kevin?
Well, obviously, I get the chance to play Beckett's conscience, so the moment that we have on stage together where I'm basically in his head giving him the idea to become a martyr is a wonderful moment in the opera. I love it. But I guarantee you at the end of the opera, the final chorus, if that doesn't make the hair on the back of your neck stand up, nothing will. It's one of the most beautiful moments in all of opera, this final chorus. And it really is worth the price of admission to hear that. So I guarantee, don't leave. Stay till the end. It's going to be really something.
Any other questions from... Yeah. We've got time for one more.
Everybody. And the question is, after this wonderful opportunity here, what are you going to be doing next?
Well, start at the end.
Well, this is my contemporary opera season, because after this is over, I'm going to Central City, Colorado, where they have a music festival in the summer up there in the mountains, Rocky Mountains, and I'm doing a production of Ned Roram's opera Our Town, based on the Thornton Wilder play. So it's the 75th anniversary of the play, and so again, this is an opera that hasn't had very much time in the professional companies. It's been done a few times by some small festivals and universities, but I'm really looking forward to that. And then later in the season, in the fall, I'm going to resurrect Martin David Levy's piece, Morning Becomes Electra, that opened the new Met in 1967, and I did a production of it in Chicago in 1998. We're going to do that at Florida Grand Opera in Miami, so that's coming back. So it's a contemporary opera season for me coming up this year.
I'm going a totally different direction. I'm actually going to be trying my first Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof. So, and then right after that, I'm doing my first Valkyrie in concert, and then I'm doing a couple of Otellos in concert too. After that too, so go from Fiddler to back to.
Well, after this, I go back to the 18th floor. And in June, I'll be in Cardiff for the Cardiff Singer of the World competition, and in August at the Verona Arena for Domingo's Opralia competition. Oh, but basically, it's the 18th floor.
Maestro, what's next for you?
La prova, Jesus. I go to many concerts, and Attila di Verdi. But in the place where Attila came in Italy, Aquileia is a same city, fantastic production, and the project with the young, because I think it's important the new generation like opera, because the cultura in Italy now is a little too down, and the beginning study, our melodrama, our tradition is important for us. I think experience the condotto, singers, is important for the young. I have two projects with the young singers, mm-hmm. Italian. No murder, eh?
Yeah. It's difficult.
I will be in London, Covent Garden, for Don Carlo, the same production that I just finished in New York, Boccanegra, a Russian recital that I do since many years at the Staatsoper in Wien. Then Don Quixote in the White Night Festival in St. Petersburg, and Tanglewood, Verdi Requiem, at the end of July.
Wonderful. Yep. That's a heavy schedule.
And then holiday.
Ah, there you go. Susan.
I just finished covering Turandot at the Met, and so I thought, okay, I've done all the dramatic soprano stuff I'm going to do, so I'm going back to my youth, and I'm going to sing The Countess in Marriage of Figaro. Of course, I need, like, Bryn Terfel to sing The Count or something, but we'll make that work. And then I'm going to sing my favorite opera in the whole world, which is Nabucco. At Florida Grand Opera.
Okay.
So, well, maybe
we'll see you.
Yeah. Hello, hello. And which Nabucco is what I sang with Ferruccio just a few years ago in Parma. And I was the only non-Italian in the cast in a theater which is extremely patriotic.
Oh, yeah.
And talk about opening night nerves. I was shaking in my boots. But it was okay. It went very well. And my Italians treated me really nicely. I have been very fortunate to have spent many years singing over in Italy, and I do consider it my second home. And at first I was l'americana, but now I'm nostra americana. She's our American, so I'm very happy.
There you go. Well, I want to thank all of you. We are so excited about this production, about seeing and hearing this work for the first time. Ian, thank you for bringing it to us. Ferruccio, thank you for being here. And all of you for joining us tonight. And we'll see you on stage opening March 30th. Yay. Thank you all.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.